At the Garcia Squared Gallery in the Crossroads, there's a piece of embroidery that shows men at work. They're building a house. Two workers are up on the roof. Down below, another guy is holding a ladder, and there's a conversation going on between a builder and a rich man. The builder is explaining that the roof is going to cost just a little more than expected. The artist who created this scene with needle and thread was actually a lumberjack in Guatemala for 30 years. It wasn't until later in life that he became an embroidery artist, creating lively, colorful scenes that resemble paintings, except that they're made out of stitched thread. They tell stories from everyday life, the Bible, and Guatemalan folklore. I'm Gina Kaufman. Today on KCUR Central Standard, we'll hear how the art of Don Antonio Ramirez Sosof ended up in Kansas City. Curator Israel Garcia is here to tell that story. Hi, Israel.
Hi, thank you for having me.
When did you first lay eyes on the embroidery of Don Antonio Ramirez Sosof?
This was actually happened during my honeymoon. You know, Guatemala just happened to be a destination, and really had no plans to besides just enjoying Guatemala.
So tell me about the trip as you imagined it.
Well, you know, I think we actually dealt with our honeymoon a little bit different than most people. We took a 6-week honeymoon.
Whoa, nice.
So it's, I think, just the person that I am and the person that my wife is. She was really willing to do the 6 weeks, and so was I. So I think we just picked a handful of destinations and
Like you really wanted to experience a place pretty thoroughly.
I did. And Guatemala wasn't the only place. It just happened to be one of the destinations. So, but we made no plans while we were in the countries. We just really kind of let the time that we arrived and really just kind of let the wind take us wherever we kind of direction, any direction that it decided.
So the wind took you somehow to this artwork. Where were you when you saw this embroidery?
I did. Well, Guatemala was a very interesting way to go about how I found this collection. This collection is, the owner of this collection is David Glanville, and he is a proprietor of Posada de Santiago, which is a resort kind of there in Guatemala. So him and his family have been there, you know, pre-80s. And yeah, so they had a long history, and they're really involved in the community. So I think it was just through that friendship. Her aunt already lived in Guatemala, so that was the reason why we picked Guatemala to begin with. We had kind of our own guide, personal guide already there, so we took advantage of that. And she's really the one that introduced us to the owner of the collection.
What do you remember the first piece of embroidery you saw by him?
Well, you know, in this case, it was very interesting because that trip was actually the first time I was introduced to his work in general and overall. When we actually ate dinner in the restaurant, it was very dimly lit, candlelight, and we really couldn't see the work itself. They had amazing panoramic views and windows. You know, we got to see the volcanoes and the lake, but not necessarily the work itself. It just happened to be above the windows, and by this point it was about 8 feet off the floor.
So your first glimpse of this stuff is dimly lit. But so you must have at some point seen it a little bit better.
Yes, yes. I mean, I knew there was something there. So I knew I was already curious enough. And myself being a curator and a studio artist, I wanted to come back. You know, I knew I couldn't do it then because, you know, it was a restaurant full of patrons. But I did want to come back. And luckily enough, I was able to introduce myself to the owner then and, you know, and ask him if it would be okay if he could bring a couple of them down the next day.
So what did you see? And how did it strike you?
It was just an amazing, I think, you know, we all, and myself included, I think we have these preconceptions of what Guatemalan embroidery or weaving is.
Can you describe that preconception?
Well, I think, you know, most people think of, you know, these geometric shapes, these linear imagery, colorful.
Yeah, patterns.
Patterns, birds, flowers, but not necessarily anything narrative-based. And I think that's really where my peak to find out who this guy was and why he was doing what he was doing.
So when you say narrative-based, what were the stories that you were able to read in the works that you saw that day?
Well, I think in this case, I could think of a piece which is Semana Santa, which is, you know, the Holy Week that is celebrated through Latin America. And I think it was just so detailed and so full of life and really depicting these processions that were really happening. And as we were visiting Guatemala, we went to Santiago, which is where he resided. And Antigua, it was very evident that it was just a big part of their culture and how closely he actually depicted it. And not only the religious sense of Catholicism, but also embedded kind of their own traditional beliefs as well.
And you could see that in the embroidery?
You could see that once you were familiarized with the entity that they follow, then you're able to kind of see his depiction throughout the embroideries.
What do you know about his story, about him?
Well, himself, I think for me, it was just, like I said, for me, it was secondhand information. By this point, he had passed away. He passed away in early 2014. So it was basically through conversations with David, the owner's collection, that was really gave me an insight of his relationship, you know, for over 30 years and how he came about purchasing each work at a time.
But what about the artist? Can you tell us the artist's story for our listeners who just are totally haven't heard it before?
Yeah, and the artist himself is just very humble. I think, you know, he started later in his life. Most embroiderers, you know, either do it their lifetime and they continue embroidering throughout their life. He really started to embroider later in his life, almost in his 50s. So I think by the point that he started embroidering, his own imagery was really uncensored. You know, he was really just embroidering what he saw, what he felt, what he dreamt, the traditions that he was kind of reinterpreting.
Okay, when you say what he dreamed, tell me more about that.
Well, he tells about his story and how he began to embroider is that he had a dream. And in that dream, he saw a traditional woman from his community wearing a embroidery of imagery, of a picture. And when he looked closer, it was an embroidery. So I think that's what really kind of drove him to do narrative-based embroidery, as opposed to these patterns or these flowers or these birds that are actually everywhere within the tradition of embroidering and weaving in Guatemala.
I want to talk to you more about his craft. But first, I mean, his story is really layered. I mean, he had been a lumberjack for a time, but there's also this story about him having to flee a mountain because of the color of shirt he was wearing?
Right. Well, there in Guatemala, back in the 80s, there was a civil war. And within the civil war, you had the guerrillas, which were traditionally wearing kind of the green, their green uniform, basically. And he really had to flee because he didn't want to be confused by these guerrilla warriors. Back in this community, most of their economy is based on either firewood that they would have to get from up the mountains and bring it down, or just kind of the lumber, the carvings, or just raw wood for carving. And I think it's this industry that basically kept them, you know, survival. It was a survival. But the only means of getting this wood is going up a mountain and bringing it back down. And I think that was one of the reasons which he decided to stop that, at least within that period, so he wouldn't be confused with a guerrilla warrior.
So how did he teach himself embroidery? I mean, that's a skill that people I know who are good at embroidery, usually mm-hmm. there's been a grandmother or aunt teaching them to do this since they were small.
Yeah, and I think for me that was the amazing thing. I think the amazing thing is that to begin with, this tradition is largely practiced by women in the culture. And there was very few to no men that actually practiced it. And not only practiced it, but did it for so long. He was completely self-taught. And I think, you know, when we think of embroidery here in the U.S., we think of these very technical stitches or these, you know, there's hundreds of stitches that you could learn how to embroider, you know, throughout your practice. And I think he really hung on to the basic, which is a single stitch, and really just layered.
Over, under.
Right, right. Just layered that stitch and turned it different directions and did patches of it to give it texture without necessarily doing these complicated embroidery stitches that we learn here in the U.S.
So he took the simple single stitch and figured out ways to make that create pictures. That is hard. I mean, the reason that you have all these different stitches is so that you can turn a corner or, you know, make something smooth. Are smooth turns of corners and things like that not an important part of his practice? Or did he figure out a way to just sort of get around that?
Yeah, I think he just really figured out a way to do it. I think the tradition of embroidering already existed. As I mentioned, they were very self-sufficient within this community. Some of the communities were growing their own cotton in their backyard. They were also using natural dye, so you could visit their homes and you had pots boiling with all these natural dyes that were using to dye their thread. They were spinning it and they were working from it. So I think that this community, he was at the right place at the right time and had all these natural resources that were already existing where he was.
When you talk about embroidery being such a the domain of women for the most part, that's also interesting when you think about him having been a lumberjack, because when I think about what a lumberjack does, I have no experience with lumberjack stuff, by the way, but it seems like you can just sort of like hack at a tree, you know, like that's a big, bold stroke.
It is.
Embroidery, you know, and is the opposite.
Right. I mean, you know, it's a 360 completely, I think. You know, it definitely went from one end to the other end when you're dealing with, you know, this very rough setting and going into this very somber, very lonely. And, you know, the work was by himself. Each piece.
The embroidery.
The embroidery took anywhere between 2 to 3 months per piece, depending on the size. And there were
little tiny details.
Yeah, and there were intricate pieces. It wasn't like he was, you know, using big blocks of color or stitching. He was actually really going into these very intimate scenes within a larger scale.
So as far as his story goes, I mean, for you to kind of interrupt your honeymoon to start working at your curatorial project with this guy, there had to be something that spoke to you in more than just a passing way. What do you think that was? I mean, was there something about his story that resonated for you really personally based on your own interests, your own life?
Well, I think myself, it was the introduction of something I hadn't seen before. In that way, and that it was stories that spoke to me directly, being Mexican and Guatemala being in the border of Mexico as well. I think it was just very interesting that I found work that spoke to me that I wouldn't have found otherwise.
What do you think spoke to you about it?
Well, I think the stories, you know, they related. Semana Santa, you know, I visited my grandmother a couple years back and we celebrated Semana Santa and how those parallels, even though we're dealing with two countries, the ceremony of Semana Santa was, the processions were practiced the same way.
What is Semana Santa?
So Semana Santa is Holy Week, and it's really just that. They actually take in, you know, they have altars, and each house has their own altar, and they have a procession where the saint goes from house to house. And it's really kind of, I think it happens during the Easter weekend kind of thing, our equivalent of it. So I think it's just really that. It's just kind of, you know, everybody redirecting that whole week to, you know, either Catholicism or Christianity, depending on how it's practiced. But it's mainly the Catholic cultures that have some indigenous kind of details added to it, such as Guatemala, even though it is primarily 80%, you know, the indigenous culture, it is also heavily, you know, Catholicized, or Christianity is a big part of their life.
In his depictions of Semana Santa, is there a detail that really takes you to your own experiences with this celebration?
Yeah, I think the caring of the saints, you know, I think as I think of stories in my childhood, it was just, you know, I remember, you know, it's basically a parade, you know, and it's, you know, it's, you see people crying and praying and really involved in this procession where these saints are being, you know, taken up on their shoulders and being carried long distances, you know, just to show their dedication to the faith. So I think for me, that it was that connection to these childhood memories that attracted me to his work.
How did people in the town seem to remember him? I mean, He had passed away by now, but it seems like with someone making such a dramatic turn in life, that would be a memorable character.
It was, and I think, you know, there was connections to him and to his work, even here in Kansas City. You know, everybody that had met him or had spoken to him spoke about him very, 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 very well, like an amazing man and very humble. You know, he didn't do well with his work. And I think because it...
Like monetarily.
Right, monetarily. You know, he wasn't able to survive solely on his work. He was always able to having to do another side job to be able to make ends meet. So I think it was kind of that as well that, you know, that you could, as an artist, you could really give up your practice if life is just keeps on pounding on you and you're not moving forward. And I think his willingness to continue to work, even through blindness at the end of his life, you know, that, you know, there's three pieces in the show that show that resilience and that willing to just produce imagery regardless of his financial situation. Some of the embroideries were actually embroidered on just shirts, you know, and not even a backing. It was just whatever. He would embroider on whatever he could find. And I think as I started looking at these embroideries a little bit closer, it gave me the appreciation of what he was doing and how much sacrifice he did and he took upon himself to continue to work.
You mentioned that he was uncensored. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of taboos, you know, that you have some of the imagery that is heavily, you know, the Catholic imagery is there. And then on the corner, you have a nude female, you know, bathing in the lake. So I think it was just kind of these things. I think it was just a point in his life where he was just really depicting what he was imagining or what he was reinterpreting of these events.
What do you think the nudes were doing in those scenes?
Well, and they were just very traditional scenes. As in Guatemala, it's actually, you could still see it that way. Life is still practiced very, as they always have. You know, nudity is not a taboo, I guess, in public as we think of it here. So I think it was just that, you know, he was just depicting what he had lived with for a long time. And I think when some of us that were raised here in the U.S., when you see those contradictions, you get thrown off.
Well, Israel Garcia, stay with me through the break, okay?
Thank you.
KCUR's Central Standard will be right back with the story of Don Antonio Ramirez Sosof. I'm Gina Kaufman. I'm Gina Kaufman here with curator Israel Garcia, whose gallery in the Crossroads is showing embroidery by a self-taught Guatemalan artist who used to be a lumberjack. Israel's path and the artist's path crossed after the artist had already passed away on Israel's honeymoon in Guatemala. Hi again, Israel.
Hello.
So you see these works of art that really captivate you, that remind you of aspects of your own upbringing and your own family's experience in Mexico. He deviates from a lot of other artists in that he's a male embroidery artist. He's using only a single stitch.
Right.
All of these things. And you decide you want to bring his art back to Kansas City. That seems like it would change your honeymoon.
It would. And I think, you know, in that case, it is actually a huge credit and love to my wife that gave me the time to be able to deal with the process of getting a work from Guatemala to the U.S.
It's, what is that process?
Well, it's a very, depending on the show, I think, you know, you deal with collectors very differently. I think in this case, because there was already a pre-existing relationship, we had already met and talked about kind of each other's lives. And like I said, her aunt was there locally, so that relationship was already existing. So I think it's really just sitting down, you know, with the collector and saying, you know, this is who I am. This is what I do. Luckily enough for me, the gallery had been open for 4 years by this point. And, you know, my reputation does precede me and had already had great reviews of the curating that I've done in the past. And it just, you know, it was easy to sell myself, I guess, ultimately, and to say, you know, this is who I am. This is what I do. This is a gallery that it's focused on Latino work, and I like to show the work. And I think, you know, he was really in the same mindset. You know, I think because it was a really close friend of his. He wasn't just a collector. It was a close friend of the artist. And he was really willing to have his share his work.
So it's about relationships.
It is. It's solely about relationships. I think anything that I do is based on the relationships that I either have with the artist or with the collectors.
So you mentioned that part of what convinced this collector to let go of some of these things, to know that they're in good hands with you, was that you explained who you were and what you do. I mean, I am very curious about your own story. Why? What brought you to Kansas City? First of all, you talked about being from Mexico.
Yeah, well, I'm originally from Mexico, and, you know, L.A. is where I was raised for all my elementary, middle school, and high school years. But I think it's really that that relationship of being from Mexico and being raised in the West Coast and then coming to Kansas City, the Midwest, you know, after when I was ready for, you know, my college years. So I think it's really kind of that, those three states or countries, Michoacán is the state that I was from, how kind of they really fed off each other. You know, I think we moved based on our economic situation at the time.
Can you explain in a little more detail?
Yeah, LA, I think it was one of these places where you just couldn't get out of the place you were. You know, we were always renting a single room that was being shared with multiple families. And we seemed not to be able to get out of that situation just because we never had enough money to be able to do so. And I think once my dad was a contractor and he had visited here, Kansas City, which was our introduction to Kansas City. And that is how I actually ended up here. My dad's like, come and visit. It's green. It snows a couple months of the year, but, you know, it's not too bad. And at that time, the crossroads as we see it now didn't exist. So for myself, a young artist being in a city where it seemed like you can make a difference, it seemed like there was a lot of voids within our community.
Like opportunities hadn't been snapped up already.
Right. It just seemed like there was a place for me. I think LA, it's so huge, and we lived in our own bubble that, you know, we didn't know anything outside of that bubble. And I think it wasn't until we came to the Midwest that it really opened my eyes to see what really is out there and what really is in the Midwest, because we had no idea or concept about what the Midwest was.
What was different about it than you expected?
Well, for me, I think the biggest change is how segregated it was. You know, LA was just everybody is on top of everybody, and cultures didn't seem to really have these heavy segregations as we saw here. I think we happened to very luckily settle on the west side here in Kansas City. And, you know, I don't know, my dad, same thing. It's because of my dad. My dad worked closely with the Guadalupe Center, and we just settled in that community.
What year are we talking about?
And this is back in 97. Back in 97. So at that point, you know, there was the West Side existed there, and there was, you know, it was very affordable. You know, you could purchase a house then for $30,000 to $40,000 and just make it your own.
And you came here as a young artist. It seems like you've really gravitated into curating. Can you talk a little bit about how that journey has been for you? What draws you specifically to curating?
Well, I see my curatorial practice as I see my studio practice. I don't really divide the two. I think I curate how I create. And by that, I mean, I I'm a very emotional artist. I'm dealing with childhood memories and trying to reinterpret those or trying to understand those memories and what I remember.
Kinds of memories is it that you're trying to?
Well, I think, for example, I think my dad dealt with a lot of alcoholism throughout my childhood. And I think it's, you know, reinterpreting these emotions or these images that tend to flash back, and whether I don't know if as a child I added to those memories and kind of made them my own and embellished them, or they're actually memories that actually happened. So I think it's just really dealing with these memories and trying to cope with them, you know, in my own way. I am one of three children, and I am one of the, at least a practicing artist. I think they're, my brothers are creative as well, but nobody that has taken it into a career.
So you in curating, you're also trying to process your own life experience?
I do. I think, you know, I curate very emotionally. You know, it's really not about having a white gallery and trying to produce something aesthetic. I think I really try to tell a story, as with Don Antonio's work. I really, you know, these were 28 pieces that really had no, no pun intended, but no tie to each other. They were just very, very produced very individually. You know, he didn't necessarily work in series. Series as we think of it here, some artists.
He created
do.
What was on his mind at that moment.
At that moment, right. So each piece is very standalone, very individualized. And it took my own relationship from being Latino to understand these stories and how I wanted to relate them to each other. You know, I had create a cohesive show, and I wanted to tell a story through his work.
Are there two pieces that you saw a relationship between that you think someone else might not have seen?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, I think there was a couple that I thought, you know, there was one of them, I think, that, and it was evident, maybe, and maybe because they were produced very differently. But there is a story that is told in three panels, which I grouped, that really tells a relationship of how, within his community, how they flirt with each other.
And how they flirt with each other?
Yeah. So, and it was basically pulling at each other's clothes. So the male would pull on the female's blouse, and that was kind of the indication that he was interested. And there was these three panels that kind of showed this progress, or the way I interpret them is this progress of like the flirt, the dating, and then the marriage.
You know, we just have a moment left, but I am curious that you say that as a curator, you're interested more in the stories than in the aesthetics. And there is such a movement away from content, at least in the sort of academic art world, that it's all kind of is all form in some way. Do you feel like you're going against the grain?
Well, I think I feel that I do what attracts me to the work, what attracts me to certain works. And I think that ultimately I curate because I want my audience to leave with an experience. You know, I really don't want them to come, see the work, drink a glass of wine and leave and, you know, never remember that. And I think it's the continuous positive comments that I get from my shows that lets me know that I'm in the right track, regardless of what the art world seems to be doing outside. I continue to curate very honestly, and I continue to create these experiences. And you know, there's been multiple instances where, you know, I've been told by the First Friday audience that I actually have one of the better shows.
Israel Garcia of Garcia Squared Gallery, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Works by Don Antonio Ramirez Sosof are on display at the gallery through December 29th. Be sure and check them out. When we return, a local researcher on Neanderthal jewelry. That's coming right up. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and now for something else entirely. We're going from recent news to fashion trends from the Neanderthal period. Our guest will be able to explain that better than I can. David Freyer is an anthropology professor at KU, and he's here to tell us about his discovery. Hi, David.
Good morning.
What did you discover? Tell me the story of what you saw and what it meant.
Well, this is what we found were 8 eagle talons, eagle claws, that show cut marks on them. They're dated at about 130,000 years ago from a site that was excavated between 1899 and 1905 in Croatia and Central Europe. It's a very famous site. There are lots of bones from the site, Neanderthals and animal bones and tools, etc. And the person that excavated the site was very careful, and so we're pretty sure where these came from. There are only Neanderthals found at the site, and there are 8 talons and also a finger bone, if you call that in a bird, but a bone right behind the talon called a phalanx that show, I think there are 21 cut marks on that particular bone.
So take me, set the scene for me. Where are you when you discover this? Take me through it as though I am you.
Okay, well, to go to the beginning, I've been working at the site on the human bones and teeth for a long time. And I work with a colleague there named Yakov Radovchich, and he had a daughter, has a daughter, who took over his position as the curator, and as she did of the collections.
A collection in Croatia?
In Zagreb, yeah, which is the capital of Croatia. And when she went through the collections, she found these eagle talons, and she emailed me and said, I found these, and I couldn't believe it because the person that excavated the site found a lot of animal and human bones with cut marks on them, and he described cut marks and cannibalism, etc. But for some reason, he missed these completely, and he was a very thorough scientist. So I went there a little more than a year ago and looked at them and almost fell off my chair.
Why?
Well, because you don't expect this with Neanderthals.
Why not?
Well, yeah, that's a good question. Why not? Because as more work is done, there's more evidence that Neanderthals are doing this. But most people think of Neanderthals as stumbling, mumbling, bumbling fools, you know, that weren't able to really find the cave at night that they slept in the night before.
Well, yeah, I mean, people say Neanderthal sort of figuratively, like, what are you, some kind of Neanderthal?
Yeah.
Like, that's what they mean. But what is it, when you see cut marks on an eagle talon, what does that mean to you? Because to me, that doesn't have great significance on its own.
Well, the cut marks are associated with disarticulation, with removing the talons, the claws from the foot. One thing I left out was that we have at least three different eagles, because the same talon is repeated three times. So we're not sure how they were capturing these. Probably not from corpses, but probably they were catching them somehow. But the cut marks are associated with removing the claws, but they also are eroded, and we think that they were wrapped into some kind of probably some kind of a necklace or a bracelet. The other thing about the talons, if you think of your fingers, they show that they were rubbed on the sides of the fingers, not on the claw part, not on the palmar part, but on the sides of the claws, which suggests that they were being rubbed together, or they jostled together as they were assembled into a necklace.
So did we not think before that Neanderthals adorned themselves with jewelry, or did we not think before that Neanderthals had the sort of technical or intellectual or whatever kind of capacity to remove a talon from an eagle? Or is it some combination of the two?
It's both. Like we said, people are thought that Neanderthals were not capable of appreciating this kind of jewelry. The other thing that's important about the site is that there are eagle talons found at other Neanderthal sites in Europe, but only seven. And we found at Krapina eight, so there are more at this one site found together. And at the seven that are found at all are all in different levels and probably were pendants, certainly not in the form of some kind of jewelry that's found.
What's going through your mind as you're making these discoveries, which it's interesting because we think of these kinds of discoveries as happening out in a field somewhere, digging up remains, but not necessarily within collections, sort of things that have been dug up that people have seen but failed to see meaning in them, perhaps.
Yeah, well, like I said, the guy that excavated the site was interested in cut marks on bones, so we're really surprised that he missed them. And you asked me what my feelings were. I was stunned when I saw them. I almost fell off my chair because they were so clearly modified by humans. And the more we studied them, the more it was clear that they were assembled in some kind of a jewelry item. So the other thing is that the person that did it was, she's a friend of mine, but I knew her as a little kid. We used to pick her up at kindergarten and and take her to a bar, and she would play outside, and we'd drink beer and talk about anthropology. So I've known this woman for almost 30 years, and it was really a great feeling for me that she was able to find stuff in the collections that her father couldn't find. And the material was sitting behind me, less than 5 feet away, and I never paid any attention to it. Of course, I was working on the teeth and the skulls. But
never let them tell you that bringing a kid to a bar doesn't have possible positive outcomes.
She said she spent half her life running around in front of the bar. We went there when I was just back there a few weeks ago, and we were laughing about it. So,
the pendants on these early necklaces are eagle talons, as you mentioned. Does this tell us anything we didn't already know about the relationships between humans and other animals, eagles in particular, during this time period?
Well, it's odd that there aren't a lot of eagle talons that are found in the modern Homo sapiens populations until much later in time. The fact that we found 8 of them suggests that Neanderthals had the ability to put them together into some kind of an assemblage, a jewelry item. Why they got lost? There's a hearth at this top level, and there are cave bear remains, and the eagle talons are not burned. We think there might be some red ochre on them, some colorant on them, and we also have evidence of fiber, we think. That's the next part of the analysis that we're doing. It could be pieces of feather. We don't know for sure.
Do you think that it's purely aesthetic, what was happening with these talons? Or do you think that there might have been some function or meaning that we just have not deduced yet?
Well, the tips of the talons are not broken. They're a little bit eroded, but they're not broken. And there's no evidence that they were using them as a borer or to drill holes or anything. All of the evidence is at the other end, not from the pointed end of the talons, but at where they articulated with the bones of the foot, suggesting that they were tied together and with some kind of fiber, or maybe sinew or something. So I don't think there's any evidence of any of the other talons at other sites that were used as tools. And the irony of this is if this was a discovery that was found associated with modern Homo sapiens, everybody would say, oh, yeah, it's a necklace. You know, everybody would think that it was a part of an aesthetic assemblage that a modern Homo sapiens put together. But in fact, it was when it's found in Neanderthals, people say, I don't know.
Do you think of having an aesthetic as being some kind of a measure of intelligence? Because you were saying before that this is surprising because of that people think of Neanderthals as maybe having been a bit bumbling and that kind of thing. So do you see that as a measure, like from an evolutionary standpoint?
Well, to tell you the truth, it wasn't surprising to me. It was surprising to some of the others in the field that think of Neanderthals as the Geico Neanderthal and not a Neanderthal that has modern-like abilities. They were burying their dead. They were putting offerings in some of the graves. There's another site in Italy where they were cutting off the ends of bones of the wings, probably to harvest feathers. We know that they were using colorants. So there's a lot of evidence that Neanderthals had some level of sophistication. Maybe not as much as we associate with cave paintings and stuff, although there's even some cave painting now of Neanderthals, but never to the beauty of bison, you know, running across the cave walls. But still, there's some rudimentary knowledge. And that Neanderthals were involved in aesthetics. And I think as more work is done, more careful work is done, new excavations, going back through old collections, more and more evidence will materialize that Neanderthals weren't those stumbling, mumbling, bumbling fools, but they actually had a lot of shared abilities with us. And we know that they were interbreeding with modern humans because we have some unique Neanderthal genes in us. So the view...
So we're a little bit Neanderthal?
A little bit, 2% to 4%.
All right.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and the genes are not necessarily bad genes either. I mean, you know, there are good genes associated with some of the unique Neanderthal features. And nobody would have predicted that 20 years ago. Everybody thought Neanderthals were extinct side branches with nothing to do with modern humans and shared no modern human capabilities. So there's been a real paleontological discrimination against Neanderthals since they were found.
For a very long time.
Yeah, for 150 years, yeah.
Do you have a theory on why they wore necklaces?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they were wearing them to make themselves more attractive, either as a man or as a woman. I mean, we don't know who was wearing them. We know from other sites that they were, like I said, were collecting feathers and probably using them in their hair or whatever. So, I mean, it's easy for paleoanthropologists to run amok and tell all kinds of stories called just-so stories. But
what do you mean by that, a just-so story?
Well, it's just so, it's just so true, and, you know, maybe it's really not true, and it's something you can't ever prove, but you can just speculate on. But what we concentrated in our article was that this appeared to be jewelry and that somebody wore it and only Neanderthals are at the site. And so the cave bears weren't wearing them. The talons are definitely modified by stone tools. They were cut and then they appeared to be wrapped. And so
do you think these items would be popular today?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I should have brought a colleague of mine who's a photographer there has been making T-shirts with talons all in a necklace. They would definitely be popular. And I've been in contact with people in Oklahoma that have raise eagles for their feathers, Native Americans, Comanches. And they were really excited to hear about their Neanderthal cousins having an appreciation for eagles just like they do.
When you see people in jewelry or even possibly put on jewelry yourself, do you see it in a different light, knowing how far back this practice goes?
Oh, not really. I mean, you know, you're not. Are you wearing any jewelry? You're not wearing
a small amount.
Oh, okay. Well,
for example, like I am wearing a wedding ring, and that is a piece of jewelry that carries specific meaning and fills also a social function. And yeah. I guess I wonder about how, to what extent jewelry can be functional in that sense, not functional perhaps as like a tool that you would use to dig, but functional as something that identifies you in a certain way.
Well, you know, it's a very good observation. These eagle claws weren't easy to get. So, and there are at least three different, these are white-tailed eagles. These are the sea, if you do crossword puzzles, these are the erns, E-R-Ns, the sea eagles that are, there's no sea right there, but they are throughout Central and Western Europe. And they're the top aerial predator in the environment today and also in the past. So there's no bigger predatory bird. They're not easy to catch, and so you have at least three, maybe four different eagles that were caught, and they must have conveyed some sort of power to the person that was wearing them or conveyed some sort of status for the person that was wearing them. I'm sure it just wasn't, they weren't just worn by anybody. They just because of the difficulty of getting the birds, getting the claws.
Yeah, how hard, I mean, that it does sound very hard to me, but
the claws.
Yeah, how hard? I mean, that. But I've never tried to catch an eagle.
I wouldn't try. I've had birder friends who I've said, "Have you ever seen a dead eagle in the field, in the forest?" And they say, "No." It's possible to catch them. It's possible to by digging a pit like Native Americans did and putting some meat up, and then the eagle comes down and and you grab the feet of the eagle and hold on for dear life until you kill the eagle. We don't know how they were acquiring them. We assume that they were catching them. They almost for sure, I can say for sure, were not raising them. There's no domesticated animals or anything. We know that they were proficient hunters. There are big animals and small animals at this site, rhinos at this site, and small animals, deer, etc. So they were very good hunters, and they got them somehow, and then they preserved them into this necklace.
Have you always focused on the Neanderthal period?
I started off working with the people that followed Neanderthals, studied their teeth, etc., and traveled around Europe for years doing it. But then I got interested in the site in Croatia and became really good friends with the curator there and worked on toothpick grooves in these Neanderthals. They have grooves in between their teeth where they're using toothpicks to clean their teeth. And I've been working on scratch patterns that are on the front teeth, the incisors, upper and lower.
Why are you interested in those things? What do they mean to you?
Well, the scratch patterns, when they're oblique, can tell us something about whether they were right-handed or left-handed. If you imagine holding something in your left hand and pulling and then cutting it with a stone tool, every now and then you might hit your incisors and leave a scratch.
But I don't mean to sound glib, but why do we care whether they're right-handed or left-handed?
Well, modern humans are 9-to-1, right to left. And people correlate that with language because it's on the left side and the left side controls the right side of the body, and there's a weak correlation there. And it's associated with lateralization of the brain. And so this is a feature that's unique among all humans, that's 9-to-1 ratio, no matter where they are. It's 8-to-2, 9-to-1, something in there. And we've studied a bunch of Neanderthals now from the site in Croatia and other places, and that ratio is also about 9-to-1. So they're like us in that. Plus, we know that they had some genes that modern humans have that are associated with language. It's called the FOXP2 gene. It's complicated. But if we look at chimpanzees are closer to 50-50 in terms of left-to-right preference. Of course, they don't use stone tools in their mouths to cut objects. But still, the 9-to-1 ratio is an important signifier of humanity, and Neanderthals have that same ratio.
How did you first get interested enough to make a career out of it in the behaviors and artifacts, sort of puzzling out the artifacts of our ancient human ancestors?
Well, like I say, I first studied the evolution of the dentition in what's called Upper Paleolithic and Mesolithic Europe.
But you had to already be interested by then.
Well, yeah, I was in graduate school and I took courses in fossil humans and in archaeology and in bone identification, and so I was interested in it because of that. There was some possibility of going to study the transition from hunter-gatherer to agriculture in the southeastern United States, and my advisor at the time at the University of Michigan said, you know, they have a lot of material in Europe, maybe you should go there for the summer and study them. And it seemed to me like it was more interesting to spend my time in Europe than in Alabama or Mississippi.
So that's a good reason.
So I sort of scrapped that project and I went to Europe the first time in 1973. God, that's a long time ago. And then I've been going back every year once for long periods of time. And
do you have a question about the Neanderthal jewelry that really weighs on you?
Well, we have a piece of fiber now that under calcite on one of the cut marks that we're going to go back and try to figure out what that is.
David Fowler, thanks so much for joining us from KU's Anthropology Department, and congratulations on your big discovery that Neanderthals wore jewelry.
Great, thank you.
Our time is up, but you can listen back to both of today's conversations at kcur.org/centralstandard later today. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. That was a rebroadcast of a conversation we had in March. Tomorrow, you may know him as the founder of Late Night Theater, As a local bon vivant or outspoken voice for the LGBTQ community. But do you know Ron McGee's story, where he came from, what he's been through? He's our next portrait session. Don't miss it. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date. Next.